Session number 4342, Reel 5.
Interview Dr. Ring, Reel 5. So, you came actually back to the Isle of Man after your arrival in Britain.
That's right. Yes, we had to go back to the Isle of Man as long as we didn't have a job. We were not let out, quite understandably, let loose on the country, so to speak. We had to have a job. And, of course, nobody had a job when we came back. So we were all re-interned, as it were, on the Isle of Man. I don't know how long I've been there when we came back. I think it must have been longer than I remember, than I recapitulate, because my memory is that it was always very, very dark and it always rained and it was winter. But we must have been there for some time because all these things took quite long. My estimate, I may be wrong, is probably around about 2, perhaps even 3 months when we came back. But I couldn't swear to exactly the time span that we were there.
What was the camp like? Was it the same as your
It was about the same. Well, no, yeah, it was houses. I cannot even remember. We didn't go back to Oncombe. I think it was Douglas, but perhaps you can verify that from somewhere. I haven't got. There's only one very strong memory or two that I have of after the return. I learned to type there. Somebody had an ancient typewriter which he lent me, and I had a chart, and I taught myself touch typing, and I spent many hours on that. And then I remember once we were taken to the cinema, at least once, under guard. And that was a very funny film. It was, at the time, a very famous film. It was a very funny film that poked fun at the Nazis. I think it was American. I can't remember now what it was called. I found it very funny at the time, but I remember when we came back from the cinema and I was in a good mood, somebody, one of the fellow internees, sort of scolded me because he said, however funny it may have been, this is not a subject to poke fun, to that one should laugh about this in any connection. And what I also remember is all the soldiers were extremely friendly. Of course, they had a job to do, and they accompanied us. We marched in between them. They had their bayonets planted. And I remember the awkwardness that I had now to go back from the cinema to the house, whether I wanted to or not. This I always remember that. It was a sort of symptomatic for this lack of freedom, which perhaps I've said it before, which one doesn't feel if you've got it. You can go wherever you like, you can do whatever you like, but if you can't, then of course it's got something to do with imprisonment altogether. And that disturbed not only me, I'm sure all of us, greatly, although, as I say, there was no brutality or anything of the kind. They were all very friendly. But it is something that sort of sticks out of that time. And then, of course, really, the main event there was the news that we had, I think only perhaps 2 weeks or so after we arrived there, that the next transport had been torpedoed. The people in Australia that had been very hesitant to go back because it was at the height of the U-boat warfare, that had said, well, if you arrive safely, we'll follow you. Then a short time later, another transport left Australia, and on the way, they were torpedoed, and as far as I know, 40 of these refugees were drowned, and I don't know how many of the crew. And we had this news was given to us, I think shortly before Christmas, and it was very dark and terribly depressing altogether. And we were really quite shattered because, of course, they were all people that we had known for the last 2.5 years. And we were really terribly depressed about it. And we had a little memorial meeting. We recited a poem and so a little thing. And even the lager, the officers, I think they felt very badly about it. Well, we had to overcome it. It's still a very bitter memory.
Did you know some of the people?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I must have known pretty much all of them because I lived with them, more or less, some better.
Some were quite close friends?
Yes. Some I knew them very well. I mean, one lived either in the same hut or in the next hut, One was very closely connected. One had a very close common interests, of course. And then, just before Christmas, I was called to the commanding officer, and I was told that I was released to start my job as a radio mechanic at a firm in London in Kilburn. I knew nothing about this job. I hadn't applied there, but I was cautious enough to keep mum, not to say that I knew nothing about it. So they said, just after Christmas, I was supposed to have an interview at this firm in Kilburn, and I went there. They paid me the fares, no doubt. And I went to this firm and told them I'm the new trainee. And they knew absolutely nothing about me. They'd never heard of me. They said they didn't have a job for me. Sorry. And how this came about, I don't know to this day. Some muddle. And so I didn't have a job, but I was in London, and I was very embarrassed. I didn't quite know what to do. I went to the next nearest police station and told them the story. And they said, well, now you are out, And that was the end of my internment.
But how did it feel like when you were in the Isle of Man and you got this release warrant? And
well, I think it was pretty bewildering at the time. You were in normal life again. I had a few close friends, one in particular, died since, who had children, one or two boys by then. And in a way, one felt pretty sort of envious or jealous, of the normal life they had led, a normal, and of course it was far from normal, really, because the Blitz had been on. It wasn't exactly normal. But they could partake in life, and they had survived that, and they had been free.
Did you feel bitter that you missed out on something?
Well, it was all over. It's no good crying for spilled milk, Of course, we did. We felt more bitter during the time we were interned, But then I was out, and somehow I had to get back into normal life. And I then did get a job, did fire watching, and I got a job. I was very lucky. I got a job in Fleet Street. I listened in to a German radio report on radio and on the so-called Hellschreiber, which is a ribbon, a band, a paper band that comes out and where you get the news. It was picked up. And then later I monitored a D-Day, the comments, they are coming. And I was about the first person in the whole country to know the exact moment they came.
What did you mean, Mona?
I was working for Associated Press, the American news agency. Mm-hmm. And, that went to all the papers, to America too. There was quite a funny episode just on D-Day. The invasion was expected any moment. One knew it was coming. So there's heavy competition between the few news agencies that there are, Reuters and AP and UP, you know. A second plays a big part. Who is first? Scoop, you see. So this news was prepared. Invasion started, let's say. You know, flash, invasion started. But this was ready and prepared. And by mistake, a girl in the office put this in too early into the machine, you know, invasion started, before it had actually started. And this was flashed all over the world. And it appeared immediately, New York Times, all the American papers, you know. And then they had to send out an apology. It wasn't true. I mean, it wasn't long before it did become true, but I still remember that this girl was terribly shamefaced. She was playing about with this tape, you know, and sent it out. And, really doesn't, strictly speaking, doesn't belong, of course, to internment anymore. But perhaps I should mention that my half-brother, as I mentioned, I think my mother remarried, and from the second marriage there was two children, one the sister that had been sent back, and my brother, who was 10 years younger, so he was very young at the time. He left Austria legally with a so-called children's transport, which was something the Nazis let these children out, at least some, not all, but he was on the children's transport, which was something, again, guaranteed here by the Jewish community. And he came here and he landed up in Yorkshire, in Darlington, near Durham. He was accepted by a very rich man, by the gardener of this very rich man, a man who had something to do with locomotives, I think he was building locomotives. And his gardener, he lived with the gardener, and he was a sort of gardener trainee. And I visited him at Christmas 39 there. And then about May next year, 1940, he was interned. He had just turned 16 because, as I said, people between 16 and 70 were liable to be interned, and he was interned, and he was sent to Canada, and he then stayed on in Canada and married a Canadian girl, and he's still there, and he's married there. And then to...
But you didn't know at the time that he was interned? You didn't get any news from him?
I think I knew. No, I couldn't correspond. There was no question of corresponding. I knew either at that time that somehow, I think I knew he was interned, but I didn't know where he was, really. There was no possibility of, that kind of private correspondence. But he stayed there. But perhaps I should also mention, going back to the beginning, the fate of my soon after the war, I went back to Vienna for the first time, I think it was in 46 or so. And of course, first thing to do was to go to the police to find out what happened to my mother. And I went to the police station near where we lived and I asked them. And the official went somewhere behind, somewhere to the files. And he came back with a piece of paper on which he had written Nach Minsk abgemeldet, which means literally deregistered for Minsk. Deregistered, of course, is the opposite of registered. In other words, who translated, if you like, moved to Minsk. They had sent her to a concentration. They had sent both my mother and my sister to this concentration camp in Minsk. And I made inquiries through the Red Cross, but I could never find out in detail what had happened to them or how they died. And perhaps it's better not to know.
And what happened to your father, who managed to come to Switzerland?
My father, my stepfather, stayed in Switzerland throughout the war. He had no possibility of getting out of Switzerland. And he was quite well off. Of course, he was not allowed to work. Nobody was allowed to work. But after the war, I got him over. He came to me. He lived with me for a while in London. But then he went to my brother to Canada, and he died there. And so...
Did you have, after your release, did you have any contacts with refugee circles, with the Austrian Center, or...?
Not so much then. The heydays of that sort of thing were really over. The heydays of that sort of thing were when we came to England in 39. Had been on before that, but 38, 39, when most people came here. In 39, when I came, there was a thriving Austrian life in Westbourne Grove, where there was the Austrian Center. They had a house there. I don't know exactly who gave it to them, but there was a house in Westbourne Grove, Paddington, and there was that was an Austrian island, really. Of course, only German was spoken there, or rather Austrian. We had our own restaurant. It was excellent cooking, excellent Austrian cuisine. And above all, there was a little theater, Das Laternl, the Lantern, which Martin Miller, an Austrian actor, had started with many other, well, with a group, a small group of Austrian or Viennese actors. And there was quite a number of people who wrote the script. It was sort of Kleinkunstbühne, what we would now call cellar theatre. It wasn't a cellar, but it was very small for about, I think, to start with, it was about 50 or 60 people. Then they extended it something like 100 people. But to the first performance, the Austrian ambassador came. It was very festive, and it was, I believe, in all the papers. And it was really very high standard, both from acting point of view and script point of view. And, of course, the main theme of every sketch and every song were the political circumstances, the refugeedom, the refugeeness, the hate of Nazism, the desire to go back, that it should soon be all over, because I think every one of us, I have no doubt, every one of us at that time wanted nothing better than to go back as soon as possible. We felt, of course, very strongly Austrian. I mean, one spoke English in varying degrees, very varying degrees. Most people could hardly speak any, or just, you know, a little bit. But one had no contact at all. I think for years and years I really lived on an Austrian-German island here. I knew no English people at all. Only really it started sort of in earnest when I married an English girl. From then on, you know, I became much more integrated in English life. But the first few years, no contact at all.
And now you are a British subject?
Oh, yes, yes. I became a British subject pretty soon after the war. One was interviewed quite formally. It was quite easy, you know. There was no obstacles. They just wanted to find out. If there was nothing against you, you know, there was a lot for you. And so I became a British subject. I handed in my grey aliens book on which I had been a friendly enemy aliens for the last few years, and I became a British subject. And of course, I've been one ever since. And of course, this, if you like, it raises a whole series of issues and questions, a whole, well, philosophy isn't the right word, but the whole psychology of a refugee, of what it means, of what it means to have to leave your country, whether you are, how far you can possibly get integrated in one. Are you British? Are you Austrian? To this very day, I don't quite know, because I think I'm, if you like, one of the lucky ones. I've been integrated to a very high degree. I feel very, very much at home in this country. But, of course, quite understandably, not like somebody who was born here. And if I, whenever, rare occasions when I go back to Austria, I'm a foreigner there. I'm both officially and in mentality, in psychology. I feel much more at home in England, much, much more, no comparison. I feel a real stranger and outsider in Vienna and in Austria. I sort of stroll about aimlessly and in wonder, wide-eyed in Vienna, in my native Vienna, where I was born and where I had lived for 25 years. But I certainly haven't got the feeling I'm at home here. On the contrary, every, you know, I can hardly find my way about. I mean, it's like a dreamscape. You know, all the streets look very familiar, and they come back to me like from 1,000 years. You know, it's very strange.